Welcome to the ASHP Advantage Podcast, engaging the experts on ASHP Official, featuring conversations with top-level practitioners about the latest issues in pharmacy and healthcare.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Pharmacy Hot Topics, where we sit down with content matter experts and discuss what is currently top of mind in the world of pharmacy. My name is Chris Walco. I am a PharmD. However, I am a senior member in the Department of Pathology at Moffitt Cancer Center and the team lead for precision medicine. And I'm very thankful to be joined by Dr. Jenny Chern, who is an associate member and a gynecologic oncologist at Moffitt Cancer Center, as well as an associate professor at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine in Tampa. Today's episode is part of the ASHP Advantage podcast series, Engaging the Experts, featuring conversations with top-level practitioners. This episode is sponsored by AstraZeneca and Merck and is for informational purposes only, not for approved continuing education credit. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to get started talking about today's topic on optimizing PARP inhibitors in cancer therapy, including a focus on biomarkers of homologous recombination repair, HRD. So to get our conversation started, I'd like to see Dr. Chern, what do you think the optimal way of identifying homologous recombination deficiency in ovarian cancer may be for your patients?
This is an excellent question. And I know that when we're looking at gene mutations, we're really talking about some variety or variations on how we think an ideal way of identifying this based on different disease sites. So for ovarian cancer, as a GYN oncologist, we look at this very critically because it has a significant clinical implication. We know that HRD is associated with increased sensitivity to platinum-based therapy, and HRD is also associated with an increased sensitivity to PARP inhibition. So there are several testing strategies that have been utilized but consistently in the frontline maintenance trials that have allowed for HRD as a marker for treatment. And in these studies, they used Myriad MyChoice CDx. And for this platform, it looks at three biomarkers: LOH, the loss of homozygosity, LST, large state transitions, and TAIs, telomeric allelic imbalances. And they have been clinically validated as a component of HRD status in FDA-approved diagnostic tests. With that being said, optimally identifying HRD should start with germline identification for BRCA mutations. And if that workup is negative, then we should work through somatic testing. This is important because allowing for identification, not just BRCA, but also HRD, we can identify over 50% of high-grade serous ovarian cancers who will have an HRD effect. And so in my practice, I do use this standard to go along with the clinical trials. But I do recognize there are several other platforms that have a version of HRD testing as well. And so I'm curious, Dr. Walker, what do you think about these other disease sites and how we can optimally identify HRD?
Thank you. And I think it's so exciting that two of the cancer types that I work with are ovarian cancer and your team and the prostate cancer group. And it's really interesting how these two cancer groups have attacked this question in terms of what are the optimal biomarkers. And I think whenever we look at measuring homologous recombination deficiency, we can look at the causes, which are the actual gene alterations, which is kind of the route that the prostate cancer trials have gone with in the past. And then the effects, which is exactly what you just talked about, with the effects of these gene alterations, the effect that they have on the actual DNA and causing these genomic signatures and actually looking at the phenotype. The third way that we can assess homologous recombination deficiency is really an emerging area that is a functional assessment. One example of this is a novel area looking at RAD51 and markers surrounding that. And this is an assay that can change over time. And you can actually see the effect of the PARP inhibitor on this assay, but it is currently being developed only in the research setting. Currently, hopefully, once it's validated, it will move in and perhaps complement the homologous recombination deficiency assays that we already use. I think going back to that idea in prostate cancer, I use that as an example because with breast cancer and pancreatic cancer, we're also looking at BRCA1 and BRCA2, but the clinical trials for prostate cancer have included extended spectrum homologous recombination repair genes. This includes ATM, PALB2, BARD1, BARD2, the RAD51D family, and some others. And each of these kind of plays a different role in that repair of the DNA. And I think though we lump them together, and they were lumped in the FDA approval for the PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer, they may not all be equal. And we've kind of seen that happen with ATM, that it may not be the greatest predictor for PARP inhibitors, perhaps novel ATR inhibitors that are in clinical trials, and that remains to be seen. But I think it's just really interesting how these different cancers have really evolved in their biomarkers. I think ultimately what we need to see is what are the optimal measurements that are going to predict response to PARP inhibitors, to platinum agents, to the novel agents like the ATR inhibitors and some of the even hopefully second generation type inhibitors that we may use after someone progresses on a PARP inhibitor, and make sure that when clinical trials are being developed, that we use the assays that are currently available, but also use some investigational assays to see how they may perform, especially if they're looking at some different aspects of homologous recombination. So I think it's a challenge to the investigators that are designing the clinical trials now, but it certainly has given us a lot more understanding than when we very first started using the PARP inhibitors. So we've come a really long way, but with more technology, we also learn more of what we don't know. And I think this will continue to evolve.
You bring an excellent point, Dr. Valco. With technology, there are so many aspects of how we approach testing that really needs to be investigated. I strongly agree with you. In these clinical trials, it should not be just kind of one standard. We should really be looking at multiple facets of this. And to your point, not all mutations have the same weight. So I'm wondering, for HRD gene zygosity, does it matter in terms of PARP response? And for example, does a single loss of BRCA2 predict the same response to PARP inhibition compared to homozygous loss?
So I think this is such a great question. And especially now that we have assays that are able to determine if it is a single loss versus a homozygous loss. I know our in-house assay now reports that exactly how much of a loss is happening. So we get the quantitative, but also the qualitative aspects of that. And I think it has brought up this question. Some of the early data always kind of suggested that you really needed a double hit, that perhaps you had a loss of your function of BRCA2 because of a germline mutation, and then the tumor picks up another mutation in the tumor that inactivates it. And I think whenever we see that, we probably have the highest suspicion that that would be a good patient to put on a PARP inhibitor. However, and I think this is also where these effect assays and functional assays are so important, because what if you have three single copy losses of three different genes in the homologous repair pathway? That's a little bit harder to discern, and I hope that some of these assays will help us. One bit of data that we do have is from the PROFOUND trial that looked at olaparib in patients with prostate cancer. This was the large trial that initially got olaparib approved in the more advanced setting for prostate cancer in patients with BRCA1, BRCA2, as well as extended spectrum homologous recombination deficiency genes. And they did actually drill down into the group that had heterozygous losses of BRCA1 or BRCA2. This was a very small group of patients. However, of the 9 patients that had the heterozygous one copy loss, the overall response rate to the PARP inhibitor was 44%. This is contrasted with the biallelic, where they had 2 copies of the loss that they were able to see was present, and the overall response rate was 60.7%. So small group, but there was still benefit. It was just less. And so I think that this does show us that there can be some effect. We probably also need to look at the difference between the different genes and their effect. There is some preclinical data showing that all you need is one loss of CHK2, which is one of our extended spectrum genes. But again, I think this is something that really I hope our functional assays, the effect assays, if you will, to kind of keep using that terminology, will help us understand. And these retrospective, this was an exploratory post hoc analysis that when tissue gets banked, we're able to go back and look at these things. And it's really good that tissue banking and making sure that we have enough tissue for the patients enrolled in these studies is being done so that when new questions come up, we're able to go back to the trials and try to mine that data. So that was an exciting finding, and I really applaud the PROFOUND trial investigators for doing that. So I think one of the other things when we think about optimally using PARP inhibitors is, of course, the toxicities. Many patients prefer the PARP inhibitors because they are not IV toxic chemotherapy, as we've heard some patients say, and we certainly are better at managing those toxicities. And we've had those drugs around for a long time, so we have very clear guidelines about how to manage them. But there's a lot of patients who do want to just take a pill, and there is certainly benefit to that, including lifestyle benefits. So are there patients, when you're kind of weighing the ideal patient to give a PARP inhibitor to or not to give to, that you may, what are the aspects of the patient's characteristics that you may really want to understand to help the patient weigh the risk and benefit of starting a PARP inhibitor in the maintenance setting for ovarian cancer?
This is a very common question. So I'm so glad we're discussing this. So kind of just keep in mind that most patients are diagnosed with ovarian cancer are postmenopausal with many medical comorbidities, and they've completed at least or close to 6 cycles of platinum and taxane therapy. And in some cases, they might have exceeded that 6 cycles. So what that means is that if they've got an optimal dose of chemotherapy, their bone marrow has received some significant impact from the treatment. Many of these patients may have required bone marrow support with G-CSF, and in some cases, the completion of this initial treatment, they could have had to undergo dose reductions or holds. So it just takes additional time to recover. And so these patients have just gone through chemotherapy. As you mentioned, it is cytotoxic and they don't feel well. And while we have very good mitigation strategies to tell these patients that they'll continue maintenance therapy, even though a pill for the next 2 or 3 years, depending on the medication, that can have a significant impact on lifestyle and quote unquote, not feeling well. And so one of the things I evaluate is, of course, the course of the chemotherapy treatments, how they've responded, what adjustments needed to be made, and how well do I think they'll tolerate this. I think it's very important that any of these treatments, it's shared decision-making. So I have a very thorough discussions of the risks and benefits of utilizing PARP inhibitors in the maintenance setting. To kind of re-highlight what that means is it's important that they understand why are we offering the maintenance therapy. And so I reflect on the SOLO-1 data. There is 7-year overall survival data that has been presented. And it really does show a clinically meaningful, not necessarily a statistically significant OS benefit, but it is meaningful. 57% of patients with PARP inhibitors, they did receive olaparib versus 46% of placebo patients were alive at this point. 43%, almost half of the patients treated with olaparib were alive and had not received subsequent therapy. And I think that's really impactful when you think of, you know, 5-10 years ago, we did not have these therapies and we weren't seeing survival benefits to this level. So I reassured these patients that, you know, if you have an HRD mutation or a BRCA, it's really, you know, important to consider utilizing PARP inhibitors for this benefit alone. I do talk about toxicities because that's what patients have to deal with day to day. And so there are always concerns of risk for myelodysplastic syndrome or leukemias such as AML. And again, looking back at that data, it's the longest standing data that we have for frontline therapy. The overall risk of developing MDS or AML was about 1.5%, so relatively low. And one of the things that we do is we closely monitor them while they're on treatment. So this is closely monitoring their labs. Many change or significant change with the actual lab values, we can always do testing, you know, to reassure them that we'll try to detect this sooner than later. I think more importantly, outside of, you know, the rare, the MDS and the leukemias, it's really the day-to-day toxicities. These are oral medications. There are once-a-day dosing. There are also twice-a-day dosing. But at the end of the day, it's still a pill that they have to take every day. Anytime we talk about pills, there are GI toxicities that we worry about, nausea, vomiting being the most common, and that's also the most commonly reported. Anemia, neutropenia, we expect this. But again, we use those lab values to kind of help guide us in their treatment. I think the biggest thing is going to be fatigue. And so I often tell the patients fatigue is very common. Severe fatigue is also very common. And if we can overcome that and these, you know, day-to-day toxicities, then they're more likely to be successful in completing that treatment. And most patients do. There are a few that it's very difficult, but I think it's a thorough conversation of expectations and then reassuring that you're going to be closely monitoring them. And I think most patients do quite well.
Thank you. And I hope that one thing that from a precision medicine standpoint that we may be able to help you and others when you're weighing risk and benefit as part of these PARP inhibitors is understanding clonal hematopoiesis better. And for those that may not be familiar with clonal hematopoiesis, this is when we do a tissue-based somatic next generation sequencing test, or we do a cell-free circulating tumor DNA test, and we see genes typically at a lower level that are not commonly found in solid tumors, but are much more associated with myeloid malignancies. The common ones that I think are DNMT3A, TET2, ASXL1, ATM can fall into there though, and CHEK2, which is where things can get a little gray whenever we're looking at some of these things. And I think the technology and us doing all of these next generation sequencing is how we started to understand that clonal hematopoiesis can be present. We know that you can have these clones in your myeloid cells develop over time as a person ages. This has been very well described. The chance of it becoming a clinically significant acute myeloid leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome can depend on a few different factors, including the specific genes that are altered, the allele frequencies, and other patient factors. The other thing that we care about is the cardiovascular risk. And so there's a lot of effort, both from the cardiovascular side as well as the hematologic malignancy side, to understand what to do with these patients to help understand who has the highest likelihood of developing a leukemia in the future, understanding if there's drugs that we give patients that can increase that risk, or if there are other aspects that a patient may already have, underlying conditions that could be something that we modify through drug therapy or something like that from the cardiovascular side. And this is really an ongoing area. I know our institution is setting up a clinic specifically so that if you see this in your patient, we can refer the patient to a group of hematologic experts who then can work this up. And in the meantime, track that data so that we learn more so that we can educate ourselves better. So this is definitely an evolving area, but one that whenever a patient happens to read the package insert for these PARP inhibitors and sees, oh my goodness, I don't want to get leukemia from taking this drug. It's important that obviously we educate them what that risk actually is. And then also on our side, try to understand what we can do so that in the future, we can give a patient an even better understanding of what their risk may be. And that's something I'm just really excited about, even though we have a long way to go, but it's good to have these questions and to at least tell patients that we're working on it.
Absolutely. It's definitely about forward thinking on how to mitigate these concerns. We were talking earlier about ovarian cancer and prostate cancer having HRD being or PARP approval due to HRD. So I'm interested to hear in prostate cancer, there have been several new PARP inhibitor approvals in combination with enzalutamide or abiraterone. I apologize if I'm saying these incorrectly, but what is the role in the therapy for these new approvals?
So this all happened kind of in the last year with these approvals, and it is a controversial space. There's a really nice Journal of Clinical Oncology paper in the comments and controversy section that really looks at kind of weighing the risk and the benefit. So the approvals that we're talking about, so prior to these combination approvals, olaparib and rucaparib were both approved in prostate cancer in the later line setting. So in patients who had castrate-resistant prostate cancer that had progressed on prior hormone therapy, olaparib is approved for patients with kind of extended spectrum homologous recombination deficiency genes, and rucaparib was only approved for BRCA1 and BRCA2 alterations. There have been several trials, and three of our PARP inhibitors are now approved in the first line metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So basically after patients kind of progress on their androgen deprivation therapy, so your Leuprolide or similar ones like that. We now have abiraterone and niraparib, or niraparib, however you choose to say it, and abiraterone and olaparib are both approved in that setting, that first line metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer for patients with BRCA1 or BRCA2 alterations. That was based on the PROPEL trial for olaparib and the MAGNITUDE trial for the niraparib. Also interesting is the TALAPRO-2 study that got enzalutamide and talazoparib approved. So previously, talazoparib was the one that was only approved in the breast cancer setting. It is now approved in the prostate cancer setting in that first-line metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer setting. And its approval is very similar to the original approval for olaparib, where it's the extended spectrum genes. So your ATM, it actually includes ATR, CDK12, CHEK2, FANCA, and others, PALB2, RAD51C, in addition to BRCA1 and BRCA2. Who are the patients that are actually going to get this? That's kind of a bigger question, because when these trials were designed, what we were not using enzalutamide, abiraterone, and darolutamide, apalutamide in kind of that first line setting like we are now. And so a lot of those drugs have already kind of moved up in therapy. So while we know that if a patient has a BRCA1 or BRCA2 alteration, they really should get a PARP inhibitor as part of their therapy at some point for prostate cancer, and moving up the PARP inhibitor in this first line setting for metastatic disease could be beneficial. We still need long-term data to really understand the benefits. And I think really also understand, are the patients who have alterations beyond BRCA1 or BRCA2 still benefiting? Is their benefit outweighing any of the risk of toxicity? Because that's kind of why I bring up the clonal hematopoiesis question, that a lot of prostate cancer patients are older. They have a cardiac history. The drugs that we're utilizing in prostate cancer already carry some cardiac toxicity. And so we just really need to weigh the risk and the benefit. And I think the longer term data from these combination studies will hopefully try to, or help us understand those benefits a little bit better. This is definitely a hot topic area, though. And for anyone that works in the prostate cancer realm, I'm sure you're aware of these. Anyone who's taking your board certification exam, these are new approvals. So the approvals for the PARP inhibitors really have changed over time. We've seen them actually move out of the metastatic setting or the advanced setting for the ovarian cancer. And we're seeing several other approvals in some of these other cancers pop up. So it's a very dynamic space, which is what I think makes talking about the PARP inhibitors so interesting. With that, I'd like to really thank you for your time today, Dr. Chern, and just kind of ask you as kind of a wrap-up question, what are you most excited about in this space right now?
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It was absolutely a pleasure to talk with you, as always. The most exciting things that we're seeing is, you know, I mentioned this a little earlier, about 5 or 6 years ago when PARP inhibitors were kind of just used in that recurrent setting, and now we've moved into this frontline setting, what I'm hoping we're going to see is these long-term effects. I brought up this one study, the SOLO-1 long-term 7-year OS data. Granted, we don't see a statistically significant survival benefit, but maybe we're getting to that point where these patients are going to hit this quote-unquote cure, and maybe a few will. And so I'm very excited to see progress, which we had not seen. Our best treatments back then was IVIP chemotherapy and the utilization of Avastin. So adding something that is not cytotoxic chemotherapy is of great benefit to the ovarian cancer population. And as you're mentioning, this kind of has led to other disease sites, breast, pancreatic, and of course, prostate cancer. So I'm very excited to see how learning what other disease sites are identifying will help impact what we do in our own disease space as well.
I think that's a really great point, is that we can all learn from what the other groups are doing. And we have to remember that each cancer is very unique, and what we can take and understand is really dependent a lot on the clinical trials and how they're designed and the biomarkers that they're including. So I think that for those designing clinical trials, that's kind of a challenge there. But ultimately, I think we're just learning how each individual cancer, each individual is just so different, not just with the type of cancer, the stage of cancer, the histology, the genetics, but all of their comorbidities, the patient's own goals. So much goes into the person that is sitting in front of you, and helping make sure that each discussion that we have with the patients is an individualized one that when we're putting together, not just first line therapy, but later line therapies, that we have a plan and it's a really well-informed plan. And I hope that the technology will continue to evolve so that that plan can be refined for each individual patient going forward. So again, I really want to thank you so much for your time today. That's all the time we have. And again, I am Chris Welko. I really want to thank Dr. Chern for joining us for this great discussion. We hope that you've enjoyed today's discussion. Please be sure to subscribe to ASHP Podcast through your favorite podcast provider.
Thanks for joining us for the ASHP Advantage Podcast, Engaging the Experts. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time for more expert perspectives on ASHP Official.